You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here as we are here every time for this now weekly podcast to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And today, I thought it would be fun to have on one of my most fun co-hosts from the old radio show, Mr. Rod Bennett. Rod Bennett, author, Rod Bennett, raconteur, Rod Bennett, knower of Arcana, everyone's favorite Dutch uncle, if he were Dutch. And yeah. And all of the good things.
Maybe I can be everybody's hillbilly cousin instead.
Okay. All right.
It's I think Elvis had a hillbilly cousin, so I can be your hillbilly cousin.
Sure. Why not? And future seer of a total eclipse of the sun.
That's right. Yeah. We need to get you down here for that, Mark.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah.
How close does the eclipse come to Seattle? I haven't happened to notice that yet.
It's about 200 miles south of us.
So like more like southern Washington or
No. It's going across Oregon. So about where Bend, Oregon is, and it's going on a kind of cutting a south southeast arc across North America.
And right over the top of my house, I'm proud to say.
And yes,
the line of totality goes right over my roof.
Okay. Well, you know, as long as it doesn't result in some kind of Day of the Triffids thing, you know.
That would be problematical.
Yeah.
But I think we're okay. This happens pretty rarely, but it happens continuously and has done so for a long time. So
it has. It's true.
I think we'll be all right for one more go around.
This is going to be a historic thing because it really is. It hits the West Coast over Oregon and will move all the way across the United States. So a huge band of people are going to be able to witness this. Oregon's campgrounds were months ago sold out. They're all gone. Every campground that's in the zone of totality is completely booked just so people can witness this.
The last total eclipse, I believe, in the continental United States was in 1984.
Was it? Okay.
I think so. And my parents were on the staff of the First Baptist Church of Atlanta at the time, mm-hmm. and the eclipse came over Atlanta, or pretty close to over Atlanta. And I got permission with a couple of friends to climb up to the top of the big steeple that the church had back in the days when it was located in downtown Atlanta, their old building that had been put up in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And there was this winding kind of labyrinthine path that went up through the rafters of the attic and then finally opened out onto this little porch on the steeple, probably, you know, 8 stories above Atlanta. And so got to sit there and watch as the city gradually got eclipsed.
Oh, cool.
And it was very cool. It was a memorable experience. You, as most people know, you can't look directly at an eclipse and save your eyesight.
Right.
And even a lot of the various attempts that people make using welder's glasses and things like that are not very safe either. But what you do is you look at the eclipse's effect on something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so the skyline of a big city was perfect.
Yeah.
The sky suddenly starts turning this very deep, rich orange for no good reason. And your body responds as if thunder clouds are coming over or something. In other words, it doesn't feel entirely alien until you start thinking about it for a minute and looking around. There's not a cloud in the sky.
Yeah.
And so it's quite an interesting experience. I don't know if you've ever been in one personally, Mark, but
I was in a partial eclipse. There was one in 1979 in February, and of course, it being Seattle, it was cloudy.
So it just got darker than usual.
It just got darker. It was interesting. I decided to go down to the shore of what's called the Montlake Cut. So here in Seattle, there's a huge lake to the east of Seattle called Lake Washington. It's 14 miles long. And on the other side is Puget Sound. And so the city fathers, back before there was any such thing as environmental regulations whatsoever. Oh, and in between Lake Washington and Puget Sound, there is another little lake right in the middle of the city called Lake Union, which you've seen if you ever saw Sleepless in Seattle, because that's where Tom Hanks has his houseboat is on Lake Union.
Okay.
And he also performs, by the way, prodigies with his little boat. There's one scene in the movie where the girl who is interested in him parks her car near the houseboat and then realizes he's going for a trip in a little motorboat with his son. And so she follows him somehow. If you know the geography of Seattle, this is absolutely hilarious. But he zips away in his little houseboat or in his little motorboat with his son to go spend a day on the beach with him. And she follows him in her car, which is simply not possible.
Well, the magic of movies. Huh?
To the magic of the movies. There's no way in the world she could have done what she did in the movie. But anyway, he lives on Lake Union. So the city fathers, about 100 years ago, said, why, you know what? These large bodies of water afford us a tremendous opportunity for shipping and trade if we could but connect them. So without so much as a buy your leave, they cut a huge canal from Lake Washington to Lake Union and then built a set of locks from Lake Union down to the Sound, because the Sound is much lower than Lake Union. All that happened without without troubling questions about what any of that did to the environment of Seattle.
Ecosystems or anything of those types.
Yeah, nobody thought about that 100 years ago. So anyway, I decided to go down to the Montlake Cut and watch the eclipse there. And what fascinated me was it was in the morning, but the sun was well up. And so the ducks were out and the geese were out and they're doing everything. And then it got darker and darker and the ducks and geese were like, what's going on? Is it nighttime? And so they all looked at each other confused and then they all flew away to go roost while it got dark.
You can fool Mother Nature then.
Yeah. And then the sun came back out, or such as it is in Seattle behind the clouds. And then all the ducks and geese flew back and they were all like, what was that, man?
That was a short night. I don't feel quite rested as I should.
Yeah. So that was pretty great. So that's my closest experience of a solar eclipse. I've seen several lunar eclipses, which are beautiful in their own way. Back in the 90s, there was the, comet Hale-Bopp was in the sky at the same time that we had a lunar eclipse, and Mars was very clearly visible. It was just a spectacular evening. The whole neighborhood came out, and we all sat on the hoods of our cars and things and chatted with each other, and we watched the lunar eclipse. All a lunar eclipse does is it just kind of makes the moon turn kind of dull brick color for a while.
Yeah.
But it was really cool with Comet Hale-Bopp in the northern sky, this glorious, spectacular comet, and Mars. So I'm big on, I like astronomy and all those sorts of things.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yep, I'm into that myself.
Speaking of which, the other night, so last weekend, to hail the beginning of summer, because as sensible people do, and not people who are, you know, bound to the strictures of strict calendrical accuracy.
Now, after saying a moment ago that you were into astronomy, now you're about to start dissing astronomy, aren't you?
No, not at all. I'm about to start dissing the common understanding of what summer is.
Okay.
Now, some people, some fuss budget people say that summer begins at the summer solstice, which will be about 3 weeks from now. But sensible people know that summer begins on Memorial Day weekend, no matter what.
Right. No matter what astronomy says.
That's right. And everybody knows that summer really ends on Labor Day weekend.
Right.
Not at the autumn equinox, you know, because
of course our friends in the Antipodes would dispute everything we're saying.
Well, that's true, you know, and they're welcome to their own perceptions because, you know, we do these things, I think, in a colloquial, folksy, common sense way rather than in a fussy, rule bound way. That's the way I approach these things. So all that said, summer began for me last Thursday. Yes, it was a bit early, but we got on the beautiful green and white Washington ferry boat in Anacortes, Washington, about 70 miles north of us. And we threaded our way through the glorious green, beautiful islands of Puget Sound and the lovely blue water and the cloudless, and it was cloudless all weekend long, summer sky. And we went to Lopez Island in the San Juans. And had a wonderful, wonderful time. And one of the things that happened, this is my point, and I do have one, is this. One of the things that happened was on Saturday night, a bunch of the kids decided to go down to the Spit. The park where we stay is called Spencer Spit Park. And it sits out over a big triangular spit that sticks out about a half mile into Puget Sound from the side of Lopez Island. So they go down there at night and, you know, they'll have a fire on the beach and there's little fire pits there for people to build fires. And while they were down there, glory to God, the Aurora Borealis came out.
How about that?
So my kids and all the kids that were down there all got to see for the very first time in their lives with their own living eyes an Aurora Borealis. And what else? You know, I mean, talk about just a magical, miraculous beginning to summer. How awesome is that?
That's awesome.
So thanks be to God for the Aurora Borealis. I got a friend who's a photographer. And he was down there taking night shots of the Milky Way, and he got the aurora. He was able to get some images of the aurora, so that was super cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And you were just a few miles from the border with Canada there, right? Lopez Island sits right near the border, right?
It does. The border with Canada runs just north of the San Juan Islands. There's an entire chapter of American history tied up in the San Juan Islands. So. That includes
exactly where to put that line, right?
Yeah. There was this big argument about where to put, because the people who negotiated the border between the United States and Canada knew absolutely nothing about Washington geography.
It was poorly explored at that time.
I don't even know if the thing had been surveyed at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
So what they did was in the treaty, they said, well, the border will run down the 49th parallel. And then when it comes to Puget Sound, it will go down, quote, the middle of the channel. Well, and if you go to any map of Puget Sound and take a look at the San Juan Islands,
That would split a lot of islands in half.
There's a lot of, it's a real challenge. And so there's a main channel that runs south of the San Juans and another main channel that runs north of the San Juans. So the Americans said, well, obviously, they meant the channel north of the San Juans. So we get the San Juan Islands. And the Brits said, well, obviously, they meant the southern channel. So we get the San Juan.
Right. Well, that they had narrowed it down quite a bit when they got to that point. This wasn't too long after it was 54-40 or fight, you know.
That's right. And so we would have owned a lot of Canadian real estate.
Absolutely. Or else they would have owned all of Oregon, by which at that time was meant Washington and Oregon.
Right. Yeah. Oregon Territory was Washington and what is now Oregon as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, what we did was we put an armed camp at the south end of San Juan Island, which is the biggest of the San Juan Islands. And the Brits responded by putting an armed camp on the north end of San Juan Island. And there was this tense standoff through the 1850s until someone shot somebody else's pig. I forget.
Oh, the pig war. Yeah, the pig war.
Yeah. So there was some pig that was some, I think it was an English pig rooting in an American's garden or vice versa. I can't remember. But at any rate, somebody shot the pig. And so there was much saber rattling, and the British Empire and Her Majesty the Queen and the United States under President James Buchanan seriously thought about going to war, ostensibly over the pig, but really because they wanted these islands. And the commander, here's a bit of trivia for you. The commander of the American camp, I've been to the American camp. I haven't yet gone to the English camp because they're parks now. You can go and visit them. They've all been preserved. The commander of the American camp was none other than George Pickett.
Ah.
Who would go on to immortality as the leader of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg, where he had his leg blown off. Yep. And never forgave Robert E. Lee for giving the order.
Was the leg accident, was that at Gettysburg?
Yeah.
I'm sure the impression that was later, but maybe I'm wrong.
He lost his leg at Gettysburg. They, for those not familiar with, the Battle of Gettysburg, it was the largest battle in the history of the Western Hemisphere. And it really decided the outcome of the Civil War and not in favor of the South.
Right.
It was the dumbest thing Robert E. Lee ever did. And he sent Pickett's division marching straight into this massive fuselage.
A maneuver that had actually worked in previous battles.
Really?
In other words, he was trying to replicate previous successes. In other words, he knew he was completely outnumbered in the war in general. Uh-huh. And that the only way the South could possibly win was to recruit the British to pitch in on their side. So Gettysburg was undertaken, and there was an ambassador there from Her Majesty's government. Yeah, that was in power. Wanted to see if the Confederacy could win a land battle on northern soil. It was a big demonstration, really, that battle. And the whole expedition into Pennsylvania was an expedition to prove to the British that the Confederacy was viable in a land war. You don't want a whole lesson on this, but the on the Confederate side, the war was very similar to the Revolution, the American Revolution. Washington knew that he couldn't beat
The British Empire,
right. All he knew that the task was simply to keep an army, some kind of an army, in the field until France decided to pitch in on the American side. And everything depended on that happening. And, of course, it did finally happen, and that's what settled the result.
Yeah.
And the Confederacy knew also that that there was no chance to win in a heads up, head to head long war. Mm-hmm. The only chance was to get the Royal Navy, the British, to commit the Royal Navy to break up the blockade of okay. Southern ports.
Okay.
But the Navy wasn't going, the Brits weren't going to send the army to fight on land in America. They might have sent, the Navy to break up the blockade and then okay. done sort of a land lease thing where they sent, cannons and arms and uniforms and all the rest of it. So anyway, without going too deeply into it, the Battle of Gettysburg on Lee's part was a gambit. It was
I did not know that.
Yeah, it was a sort of a last ditch effort to win British support, and it failed. And then after that, it was a matter of just slowly bleeding to death.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, Pickett, who was the guy that was ordered to lead this division, into the teeth of incredible cannon fire and rifle fire and everything else, was just a few years before that was stationed at the south end of San Juan Island.
How about that?
And
you know what Hilaire Belloc said about Pickett's charge?
No.
He used it as an example of relying upon authorities, making a whole argument on the argument from authority. And he uses it as an example of something that if we didn't have reliable witnesses to testify to it, we would assume that it was legendary. He said the idea that infantry would advance on foot so boldly as to bayonet gunners at their posts is simply not believable militarily. And yet it happened. Yeah.
Yet it and it happened more than once on yeah. both sides. One of the things that a lot of people, more Civil War background, exactly the same thing happened at Fredericksburg in Virginia, except it was Union troops marching toward Confederate placements. And they just, you know, as was described by one of the Confederate soldiers, the Union troops just melted like snow before yeah. This withering fire.
These cannons weren't firing cannonballs. They were firing grape shot.
Right.
In other words, these were essentially gigantic shotguns.
Right.
And if you can imagine what a gigantic iron shotgun would do to a group of men walking towards it.
Yeah.
You can imagine.
And what's, you know, this is one of the things that's, well, this bears out Belloc's remark too. The Union troops that were advancing on, it was a place called Mary's Heights. And the Union troops were ordered to just march into this unbelievable hellfire. And they did. And the Confederate troops, one of the things that's overlooked in this story of this incredibly strange war was that the Confederate troops were so moved by the courage of the Union troops that they started cheering for the Union troops who just kept coming because they were so amazed at their courage. And the comment that Lee made after that battle, which is, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around, and yet I can believe that he said it. This is where he said, "It is well that war is so terrible, else we should grow too fond of it."
Yeah.
That is one of the places where you really feel the distinction between pre-modern thinking and modern thinking about war. You know,
I think it was Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker, who said that if you begin to look at the letters and diaries and statements of the participants in the war on both sides, the number one thing that a modern person encounters and is struck by is the almost unbelievable idealism on both sides.
Right.
In other words, the people It's full of talk of duty and sacrifice and all these other things that we get from time to time, half sincerely these days. But the degree to which these people were willing to spend their lives on a political opinion, and willing to do all of this. I mean, some people say, well, we might have another civil war, you know, for various reasons, Donald Trump or whatever. And I say, well, it'll never be another one like that, because the average American wouldn't walk across the street for the idea of the abstract idea of the Union, or for a flag, or you know, it's just those kind of people don't exist anymore. So there might be. There might be conflict, but it wouldn't be the same conflict.
Well, it's important to note as well that, you know, although the Union troops did display just unbelievable courage at Marye's Heights, as did the Confederate troops at Gettysburg, at the same time, one of the things that's also worth noting is that the Union troops who were mowing down the Confederate troops at Gettysburg, when they were witnessing that, they were chanting Fredericksburg, Fredericksburg. This was payback time.
Yeah.
As far as they were concerned. And so, you know, and that's the thing, of course, always about war, is that war brings out unbelievable courage sometimes, but it also brings out unbelievable savagery.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.